The court would like to welcome everyone here and to wish everybody a happy St. Patty's Day. I see we've got some green over there. And also, the court would like to state to counsel and their clients, we appreciate your patience in working on this case, and we appreciate the opportunity to rehear arguments with both of you here with us. So we do thank you. And if you'll announce, please, who's arguing. Well, we kind of know, but thank you. All right, Mr. Brooks.
If it pleases the court, if I may, issues number 3, 4, 5, and 6 in our brief basically address property issues. I believe that the analysis is as follows. Are these people divorced? No. If they are divorced, when were they divorced? July of 2007, not February 22nd of 2007. And equally important, is the February 7th mediated settlement agreement a partition and exchange agreement that ended the community estate as of the date of its execution? No. It's not a partition and exchange agreement. Y'all have stated a three-part test in Burns, a 2000 Fort Worth case that's cited in our brief. It must be in writing, it must be signed by both parties, and contain a reference to partition or show an intent to convert community property into separate property. Since the oral argument in this case, the court has handed down N. Ray Eaton, a Fort Worth 2014 case. Justice Daffino's on that panel. It's 2014 Texat Lexus 10726. Therein, it cited authority for it's not a PEA, and that's the abbreviation I'm using for petition exchange agreement. It's not a PEA if it does not address partition of property acquired in the future. It's not a partition exchange agreement if it is to settle disputes in a pending divorce. And it is not a PEA if the parties intended to divorce at the time that they were entered into the agreement. All those things we have here that indicate that it was not a partition and exchange agreement. And we have Gill, that is the appellee. Gill objected in writing shortly after the rendition or the prove-up to the entry of a judgment because he said that the MSA did not divide all of the community estate. Well, was there a rendition on February 22nd? The language used by the court in that short hearing is, I'm going to grant the divorce. It's pretty clear that this Court of Appeals, including everyone on this panel, is very familiar with the issues in regards to oral rendition. In Ray MGF, a 2008 Fort Worth case cited in our brief. It was per curiam, Judge Walker on the panel. It cites James versus Hubbard to expressly hold, I am going to grant the divorce in this case is not clear enough. Now, the reason why it's important to note that James versus Hubbard is cited in MGF for that express proposition is that it is also cited by Justice Daffino in Cook versus Cook, in which there was a dissenting opinion by Justice Livingston. In MFG, the court will approve the agreement and I will sign a written order to that effect was also not clear enough.
In Cook, I may not be remembering this correctly. I know that's hard to believe, but didn't the judge say, I'm going to grant the divorce, but not now?
In Cook, the exact language was, I apologize, my notes indicate that in Cook it says the court will approve the agreement, I will sign a written order to that effect.
Right.
Okay. Here we have, I'm going to grant the divorce. I will sign the decree upon presentment. It's our position that those are factually indistinguishable from the express holding is I'm going to grant the divorce is not clear enough, which was what James versus Hubbard recited as holding in MGF. Then another issue becomes, okay, assuming somehow that I'm wrong on that, which of course I don't concede, can oral renditions be set aside by a trial court? Yes. It's just another interlocutory order, and the cases cited in our brief show that where after this alleged rendition occurs, the court then addresses new issues or adds duties that are not within the rendition, that sets aside the oral rendition. And in this case, on March 14th, that's after the February 22nd purported oral rendition, the court signed an amended temporary order that converted the agreement to increase support in amount that the parties had entered into and order it paid in March and April after the date of the oral rendition. It converted it into a contractual agreement into an order of a court for which contempt was a remedy for enforcement. And in fact, after the March agreement, after the March temporary order was entered that upped the amount to be paid and extended it to March and April, the court did in fact enter a contempt judgment against Gill for failing to make the full and increased payment for March and April. So you have not only an increase in the duties and obligations after the alleged oral rendition, you have the court actually enforcing by contempt the failure to perform. And as we know, if there's a final judgment rendered, the temporary orders are only enforceable as to pre-rendition breaches. Also, the July 25th decree itself constitutes, under the cases that we cited, a judgment that sets aside the prior oral rendition. Here, we set forth in the reply brief when it was argued that the July 25th decree was essentially the same as what the MSA was. We pointed out all the different things that were different. And in addition, the July decree imposes a joint duty on Peggy to manage the $92,000 estate of the minor child established by community property. While in the MSA, she was to be the custodian of the account, but Gill specifically was to manage the account. Now, if it was in fact set aside, that's one issue, because then we would look to see, okay, what about July of 07? There's a decree that was a signed written decree that was entered that date. Now, our argument is that it's ambiguous. If the court is aware, the shorthand I use is the layman language. It was a case out of the Supreme Court, and it directs that language like this judgment resolves all parties and all claims. That is language that's sufficiently clear, standing alone, to indicate an intention to enter a final judgment in a case where the judgment is entered not after a traditional trial on the merits, the same situation we have here. But as we cited in our brief, there are cases that have held that the content of that judgment can raise an ambiguity even as to that language. Now, as we know, apparently the absence of an express ruling is not good enough to raise an ambiguity because the Supreme Court has told us so, but the Supreme Court has the cases that we cited that have held the presence of other things within the judgment can make it ambiguous. What we pointed out in our brief is that here we have a situation where the judgment itself says it is an agreed final judgment by virtue of the signature of the parties here too. It says that the MSA merges with the agreement that is the judgment, and it says that the property division is based upon an agreement incident to divorce, a document separate and apart from the decree, when in fact none existed at the time, and there's still not an agreement incident to divorce in the record as we speak today. and the signature blocks that were there to indicate the agreement of the parties and or their attorneys are there but all blank. We believe that meets the ambiguity standard, and so therefore the cases that we've cited says, well, what you do is you look to how did the parties and the court handle this case after the entry of the, or the signing of it, of the judgment. Well, now remember, the judgment was signed on July 25th of 07. Now, more than 30 days passed, as a matter of fact, 33 days by my count, when a motion to get an AID was filed by Peggy. On October 25th, well over 30 days later, the court signed an order addressing the over $1 million property division equalization payment that's provided for the, in the MSA, but is notably omitted from the July decree. On December 10th of 07, Gill files a motion to get an amended decree entered, taking the express position that the July decree was interlocutory. 10 days later, in December 20th of 07, the court actually signs an amended decree. March of 08, the court enters a finding that expressly holds that the July 07 decree was interlocutory. In the spring of 09, Gill files a motion to order the parties to execute documents and for the court to sign a second amended decree of divorce on the express basis that the July of 07 decree was interlocutory. Shortly after that, now we all remember we're in the middle of 2009, Peggy files her motion to enforce the temporary orders that were entered before July decree, agreeing with Gill that the July 2007 decree was interlocutory. And then on May 3rd of 2010, the court enters a temporary injunction against Peggy from disposing of the property that she had received in the MSA based upon the based upon Gill's petition for this temporary relief. So it was up until the very end of 2010 that we believe everybody, both parties and the court, in writing, has been taking the position and operating on the idea that the July 2007 decree was not final, that it was interlocutory. Okay, if it's interlocutory, then Votrain applies, because we don't have a property division set forth in the decree. If it's not interlocutory, it's still void. Why? Because an MSA, when it's enforceable, mandates a judgment strictly in conformity of all terms and conditions of the MSA. We don't have that. An SNA restaurant cited in our brief, if you don't have consent as to each thing that is entered into in an agreed judgment, by that I mean the content of the judgment, if there isn't an agreement as to a portion of it, that case says it's void. Now, admittedly, I've not found a case where, as here, this is a collateral attack. This is not a direct attack of the July decree. We're saying it's interlocutory, so it can't be a collateral attack, because collateral attacks are only as to final judgments. And we're saying if it's not interlocutory, it is void, okay? It is void because the provisions of the MSA says that they are intended, the provisions of the MSA itself says they are intended to be incorporated into an agreed final decree of divorce. It also states that the terms of the agreement will be incorporated into an agreed decree of divorce, while the July decree says that the agreement of the parties under that section incorporates the AID by reference into the final decree, not the MSA, but the non-existent AID. The agreements and terms of the final decrees are a merger with the MSA, and the decree controls where there are any differences. Now, this is not a Campbell versus Campbell situation. This is not a situation where the judgment that we're looking at can be supplied, the MSA, by virtue of the incorporation of the MSA into the agreement. Why? Because this MSA says it must be incorporated into an agreed final decree of divorce. And this court has held it is not an agreed judgment where there are signature blanks and none of them are filled out. So there's another issue. One of them is that the the calculation of child support. I want to point out that the Supreme Court has recently held in Office of AG versus Scholar that the common law defenses to calculations of child support arrearages simply don't apply. I will state that the case is not quite that broad, but it does say that the common law defense of estoppel doesn't apply. We believe here that what the court did was simply in equity, in the court's view of equity, said, well, we're going to give him credit.
Can you clear something up for me, please? In, I think it's your first issue, you talk about the security agreement.
Yes.
Is appellant receiving, has she received the money?
No, she has received money, but she's not received the post-divorce payments.
Okay.
Your Honor, this is all about, is there a divorce, and if so, when?
Well, I understand that, but you've got an issue that we're going to be talking about, and so I just want to make sure I understand that what that issue is.
Yes, and I also appreciate that if it's divorced and it's been paid, that may even change your jurisdictional analysis, mootness, whatever. I'm not conceding that, but yes, ma'am. You're, as an officer of the court, I have been informed that the payments have been made and received.
The payments have been made and received.
Yes, ma'am.
So then mootness is
not
raising
applicable.
Its head.
Raising its head, but obviously it's not applicable because they're not divorced.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon. Justice Dofano, I think you're correct, and I think we may be saying the same thing. The payments have all been fully made and accepted, and so I think the issue is if there's not a final decree, his argument is then mootness does not apply. If
right,
we do, it is moot, and the security agreement would be moot because all the payments have been made. So, that was going to be one of my first arguments. I believe that security interest, for all the other reasons we put in the brief, are now moot because all the payments have, in fact, been made and accepted by the appellant.
Okay.
Opposing counsel goes at great length to discuss actions that were taken after the July 2007 final decree of divorce, all of which are more than 30 days after that decree became final and appealable. So much of those references are inapplicable as to any of the actions because the trial court would have been without jurisdiction unless an action was filed under Chapter 9 of the Family Code, which would be a typical situation if there was omitted property or a clarification under Chapter 9.
He said everybody agrees that 2007 decree was interlocutory.
No, that's 100% incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay.
We disagree. We believe it is a final, non-appealable judgment and that he is trying to affect, in part, they have different remedies, but they are trying to collaterally attack that final judgment. And if I could, I'm going to backtrack a little bit and clarify some things that are set forth in our brief. We believe, of course, the trial court rendered the divorce in February the 8th of 2007. And we've quoted it at length, February 22nd, in the February 8th mediated settlement agreement, which this court is very familiar with, the shortcut and the powerful enforceability of MSA agreements under the Family Code. The MSA specifically stated that the parties, it was irrevocable, complied with the Family Code. They then were to go to court, which they did do, The appellant went to court before the judge and specifically asked the judge to grant the divorce pursuant to the MSA. And specifically, the court said, after they had petitioned the court and a specific question was asked of the appellant, who testified under oath in sworn testimony, are you asking the court to approve the mediated settlement agreement, approve the agreement you made with your husband about your assets, liabilities, and your child, and grant a divorce? Her answer was yes. And the court said, I'm going to grant the divorce pursuant to the terms and provisions of the mediated settlement agreement that's been stated herein today. And I will sign a decree upon presentment. And that is typically what the judges do when they are doing it by approval. We have more than that, though, Justice Dofano. The trial judge in this case specifically made a docket entry, and we've cited cases that the court's entitled to look the entire circumstance to try to determine the intent of what this judge was trying to do. Quote, divorce granted pursuant to mediated settlement agreement, decree to be signed upon presentment. And that is typically when you do your prove-ups, get the rendition, then you later on prepare the final decree of divorce. It goes more than that, Justice Dofano. The appellant specifically filed documentations with the trial court saying that the MSA was a complete and final resolution of all issues. In fact, the MSA itself says it's a complete resolution of all issues and disputes between the parties. They each release each other from all the claims specifically articulated. And then in June 1st of 2007, the appellant specifically filed a brief with the court stating that the divorce was granted on February 22nd, and specifically stated that the plain language of the MSA shows that it divides all of the parties' assets and liabilities. Quote, on page 6, Clerk's Record 150, in this case, the MSA demonstrates that the parties have entered into a comprehensive settlement agreement, which finally resolves their competing claims for divorce and child custody and leaves no remaining issues for a trial on the merits. The trial court then does sign a final decree of divorce. After that period of time, no action is taken, which would extend the plenary power of the trial court. We have a final decree of divorce. In an attempt to, and the appellant and our client, my client, has paid all his child support pursuant to the decree. In fact, he's ahead on his child support. He's made every payment of alimony, not alimony, but the payment terms that calculate exactly to the number of payments that start on March of 2007, which coincides with the divorce grant. So the first payment he makes, 87 payments, is the very month after the February 2007 rendition. Once again, consistent with a final decree of divorce. All 87 payments are paid. All 87 payments are accepted. We have a final decree that is not appealed, or a motion for new trial is filed. So we've got a final decree of divorce. So essentially, what do? They file a new petition, a new lawsuit. And that is what is tried to the bench that arises from this appeal. So what we're really appealing is not the final decree of divorce, but the judge's ruling after a two-day trial of their petition, which was a breach of contract. Whether they name it correctly or whether they don't name it correctly or whatever avenue they're really essentially trying to pursue, I think some things are very clear. We've got a final decree of divorce. Then they can try to file, if they're successful, claims for, as we know, if there's omitted property, which even, I think it's just it's somewhat different than other issues of the area of the law, but the Family Code and the legislature has enacted Chapter 9, which allows a court to go in and divide undivided property. So you can, and this happens, so we all do it. Some of us, it's happened to me. There may be omitted stock account that just didn't get divided. It doesn't mean the final decree of divorce is not a final divorce. It's just what happens. And that's, and the remedy was that the you can have those Chapter 9 post-divorce final judgment proceedings. The family code gives the trial court continuing jurisdiction over qualified domestic relations orders because obviously we know retirements can keep going and those orders don't get divided timely. Sometimes the employer won't acknowledge the quadro and we get all those headaches of trying to get those done. And so there's not a time limit on those.
So let me ask one quick question because I haven't reread the MSA or the alleged decree again. Do either of those have that kind of standard clause that we see in a lot of decrees that talks about if there's omitted property, then, you know, if it wasn't on the wife's disclosure, then it belongs to husband or it's going to be one half owned by each? Do you recall?
It does not. It has. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't know that I've looked at it for that exactly. And I know sometimes we put those in.
Yeah.
Sometimes those are negotiated because, you know, one spouse may not trust the other. We call them the moneyed spouse and the non-moneyed spouse.
Right.
But the moneyed spouse, we may not fully trust that they disclosed everything in the inventory. And so we'll kind of shift the risk to say, okay, if you're at your word and you've really disclosed all the assets, if we find anything else after this that you didn't disclose, it's ours. And those are typically we negotiate sometimes back and forth. That doesn't have it.
Okay.
But they did. The court did specifically put in clarifying orders, which it's got statutory authority anyway, so it kind of took a stab there. It's stated on page 20 of the final decree. The court expressly reserves the right to make orders necessary to clarify and enforce this decree. So that's close. It's got a specific clause of relief not granted, the ability to enforce in all writs. The court recites that the divorce was judicially pronounced and rendered on February 22nd, 2002. That was not challenged or appealed in any fashion. So the format that they tried to take in filing these post-divorce decrees was a breach of contract type of action. The trial court, the guidelines on what the trial court wants to do are quite broad under Chapter 9 of if I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, if that's what this is, if it's an implementation. The court's simply brought forward trying to get the property disposed. There was disagreements on both sides on how to do that, which is also not uncommon. I've been involved in those to where you may have accounts that have just not been distributed by the holding entity, a financial institution, Merrill Lynch, or things of that nature. And the court resolved all of those issues and was able to implement, and we've cited cases to that, where the court is trying to implement or enforce the terms of compliance with the agreements. And that's really what happened. These parties need to be divorced. It's been 8 years since this prove-up has been done. Millions of dollars have been exchanged between these parties. The last thing we would want to have it do is this is for the appellant to come in and say, I want to redo on this. The fact that I've accepted millions of dollars of payments over these years, I've accepted every single child support payment, I've accepted every one of those 87 payments and cashed every one of them, and then come back and say, ha, I got you. Even though I didn't appeal the final decree of divorce, I get a redo. We are trying to ask, with regard to a lot of these other issues, she can't come in and say there was a final decree, ask for the entry of a final decree, brief the trial court that there's a final decree, and then not appeal that decision on something she's already invited. In fact, we would argue she couldn't really even appeal that because she asked for the very relief that she got.
Okay, so just to make sure we understand your position, Cook, can you distinguish Cook?
Yes. I think there's several factors, and I believe the portion opposing counsel read to you was a distinguishing factor as well. I can't remember the exact term, but as I was sitting there listening to him, I go, that's fine. That's not our situation. The clearest factors, Your Honor, are, number one, the appellant came into court and swore under oath that she was asking for the court to render a divorce pursuant to the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. Number two, the court specifically stated on the record, you got to put the terms I'm going to grant. I think we all know that means I'm basically granting in this context. And he states specifically going to grant the divorce pursuant to the terms and provisions of the mediated settlement agreement that's been stated herein today. And I will sign the decree upon presentment. And we're not done there. You're allowed to look at as well to determine the court's intent to look at the docket sheet where the court wrote divorce granted pursuant to mediated settlement agreement. Decree to be signed upon presentment. And that's found at the clerk's record, volume 5, 1948. We then also have, Your Honor, the appellant's filings with the trial court stating you rendered, please sign the final decree. Then we have the final decree itself that says I granted the divorce on February 22nd. And that final judgment was not appealed. I think all of those grounds, any one of which alone I think are sufficient, but added together is very powerful evidence that there was a rendition.
And when is the community estate divisible? At the time of rendition, date of decree, or any time it needs to be fixed, or?
It can be done different ways, Your Honor. That's an excellent question. The parties can contractually do it, which we believe they did in this case. They divided the marital estate. The appellant filed documents with the court saying that they divided all of their assets and all of their liabilities and addressed all the child issues, filed that with the court. Our first argument would be the MSA. Bootstrapping that would be additionally the date of rendition, which the law is clear. When you render the divorce, that's the date of the divorce. The signing of the decree is a ministerial act. I remember I got yelled at by Judge John Street one time when I was talking about rendition. He said, I don't do that anymore. I'll just sign the decree. It was on a prove up. So that obviously stuck with me for a long time. But the rendition is the date of divorce. But as we all know, the signing of the decree is the deadlines for appellate deadlines. The signing of the decree is a ministerial act, and then the appellate timetables then run, post-judgment motions, whether a motion for new trial, a motion to modify, or the notice of appeal, unless extended by some plenary power extension that would then extend the time to file the notice of appeal.
And you agree that the decree is lacking signatures?
Yes, it does not have signatures.
So is it an agreed decree?
No, it does not say. Well, it is. It is an agreed decree based on the mediated settlement agreement. It's titled a final decree of divorce, and I'm trying to be literal with you in that sometimes when we do agreed decrees, we'll call it an agreed final decree.
Well,
this
usually
one is not titled.
People sign it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Typically, it'll be titled an agreed final decree of divorce. Both parties sign it, and then the lawyers typically sign it, approved as to form only. And then for the parties, we typically put approved as to form and substance. So in this situation, clearly, the appellant came in and asked the court to grant the divorce. She testified under oath to grant it pursuant to the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. And the court said he was going to grant the divorce pursuant to the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. Our client has performed under the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. Any of the remaining issues were resolved by the final trial. That would wrap this thing up finally and let the parties go on their way.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Brooks, rebuttal.
Okay, Kent. Thomas says y'all don't agree. Everybody doesn't agree that was an interlocutory decree. You say everybody agrees. I mean, everybody on the appellant side agrees, or
Well, we listed all of the different dates in the brief and today in which everybody, the judge and both sides, took the position after July 25th of 07 that that decree was interlocutory. Okay. An agreed judgment under Campbell versus Campbell is not an agreed judgment without the signatures. There we had the signature block issue, and that y'all said, well, it, without the signatures, it's not agreed judgment. So it did not match the mediated, the MSA. The MSA required an agreed judgment, and there wasn't one. There was the statement that, that they appeared to prove up the mediated settlement agreement. I believe counsel was careful in that. I think y'all need to know he did clarify that only Peggy showed up. So the mediated settlement agreement required both parties to appear. He never did. He filed a motion and said that he wanted to rescind it, that it wasn't a mediated settlement agreement under 6.602, and that in any event, he took the position that it did not divide all of the community estate. Now, on the equities of the idea that my client has been receiving $12,500, if she's married, the $25,000 plus income per month under the disability insurance policies, she's entitled to it just like anybody else that's married because it's community property. The temporary support orders did require the payment of child support. The 2007 July decree has a provision that says that any payments he makes to her for support is not child support paid through the distribution unit and shall be not counted against it. That's another point in the brief. The MSA says that the release is effective as only as to the claims that exist that could were pled or could have been pled as of the date of the agreement. The agreement is not only dated, but it's timed. Okay, the MSA does not have, nor does the decree have, what Justice Livingston asked about the party that's not in possession gets the undivided property. In fact, it says that it will be handled pursuant to the family code. The idea that the judge gets to make the determination of what the MSA agrees is simply not true. The MSA agreement says itself that it's the mediator that they went to that gets to determine any questions of the interpretation. So we've even had cases where not this Court of Appeals, but other Court of Appeals has said the trial court is not to get involved in making determinations if the mediated settlement agreement says it's to go to back to the mediator or to an arbitrator, okay? So all in all, I really urge, I know this is the second time around, carefully read the brief. Counsel and I are professionals. I strongly disagree with a lot of his statements as to what the record reflects. Both briefs have the have citations to the record. I believe someone needs to look at this carefully as to what positions were taken by whom and when and what happened on the issue of the initialing of the docket entry. We briefed that issue. The idea is it's his initials and it's not Judge Chessman's signature. I mean, it's not even his handwriting, okay? And also—
Counsel, I have a question. Do you agree that if the February 22nd, 2007 judgment is a final judgment, that that's the end of the case?
The February 22nd oral rendition?
No, the written judgment.
That's July 25th.
I'm sorry.
If it is a final judgment, you mean not void and not interlocutory?
Yes.
If it's not void and not interlocutory, what we have sought would not prevail.
Okay. My next question
Well, on that issue, you realize there are child support issues and medical reimbursement issues, yes.
Okay. My next question is, if that judgment, if your position is that that judgment's not final, then how could your client accept benefits under the judgment? And if it was final, then it should have been appealed, right?
It's not benefits under the judgment. It's community property law. Half of the income, if she's not divorced, is hers. It's not a benefit under the decree if she's not divorced. Okay?
Well,
and you don't have to appeal
the void judgment. The payments were made pursuant to the judgment. whether Your Honor, it's interlocutory
you're not divorced,
or not.
They're not payments. I mean, I can understand the motivation of the appellee may be because he thinks it's final, but if y'all declare that they're not married, she doesn't have to give it back. It's community property.
Well, I'm married, and my husband doesn't pay me those kinds of payments every month.
Hey, but there are people that don't work at all and get quite a bit paid for a month. That's the marital property law.
Okay, I understand your position. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And by the way, thank you for granting oral argument. I appreciate it. My client does as well.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen, thank you for your briefing and for your additional arguments today, which we also appreciate greatly. Your case is now submitted.